Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The popular historian and futurist Yuval Noah Harari often declares, intelligence is not consciousness. Intelligence is the ability to solve problems. Consciousness is the ability to feel things. Now, for Harari, the problems that matter are those that we can objectively define and measure in the material world. So, climate change, material poverty, energy production and distribution, political organization, brain chemistry, disease, and the last enemy, death. And these are to be resolved by manipulating the material factors that define them. In our wondrous time, Harari and many others hope that the intelligence, the problem-solving ability, that will bring about these resolutions will come in the form of AI. Well, nobody yet claims that we have reached the point where artificial general intelligence can solve all the world's material problems. AI certainly is increasingly and impressively part of our worlds. It answers our questions. It writes our essays, not this one. It chooses the advertisements that we see, and it makes medical and legal decisions for us, sometimes of dubious quality, or at least it offers us plausible advice. AI systems perform many functions that were once deemed the exclusive province of human beings, so that today there are many who worry about the future of human work and what the rise of AI means not only for our livelihood, but also for our very identity. With each release of ChatGPT, we witness new chat-enabled derivations that beckon to us in social media, personal assistance for academic research, and offerings of AI therapists, friends, and lovers. Contemporary techniques have brought us a cornucopia of artificially intelligent tools that seem not only intelligent, but also persuasively personal. Small wonder that a few years ago, the Google engineer Blake Lemoine declared his personal opinion that one of Google's chatbots was indeed conscious and even a person. We still await persuasive humanoid robots, but we can already have conversations with our smartphones that evoke from us the empathy that we habitually reserve for fellow human beings. And AI systems are able to accomplish feats of classification, artistic production, and apparent reasoning that to the eyes of many bear all the hallmarks of human intelligence. So in the remainder of this talk, I wish to take up four topics. First, how do these various systems work? Second, I will argue that even the most person-like of AIs are not persons because persons are relational subjects and AIs are not. So taking up one of the topics introduced by Father James earlier. Third, I will claim that AIs are not intelligent in the sense that we are because intelligence is a relational grasp of reality, rather than simply a goal-defined manipulation of reality. And fourth, I'll propose that if we redefine personhood and intelligence in order to make AI fit these categories, we risk a rather dark reduction of what it means to be us and what it means to live in the world. So first, how does it work? There we go. Oh, well, there are the four questions. Lovely, aren't they? Okay, so first, how does it work? What computer scientists have called artificial intelligence has always reflected something of how their times have thought about human beings. So in the rip-roaring days of the 1950s and 60s, the atomic age, human cognition was equated with a capacity to identify and to work with logical relations. So a computer that could accomplish this task would in fact be thinking. This was the age of so-called symbolic AI, founded on the computationalist hypothesis that thinking just is the logical manipulation of symbolically represented information. And so there are a few examples of these. If any of you are as old as I am and you remember installing Microsoft Office in 1997, which I guess is not very many of you in this room, but some of you in the back, you'll remember the installation wizards. They're not called wizards anymore, but we still have, you know, click next to continue. Do you wish to install this version or that version? Click next. Where do you want to put it? Which options do you want to install? Are you looking for this or that kind of experience? These are a very primitive form of symbolic AI, essentially a decision tree in which you give input and it takes you to the next step. It's sort of a flow chart. This is the sense that they applied in the 1950s to the notion of what understanding is. Understanding is the ability to traverse a logical tree of possibilities to arrive at a resolution. And so there I have it's over here actually, the kind of basic decision making of it's rainy, it's windy, I don't want to be rained on, it's not too windy for an umbrella, I'm going to bring a raincoat, I'm going to stay at home, I'm going to bring an umbrella, et cetera, et cetera. Now, symbolic AI's greatest achievement was in so-called expert systems, great structures of these linked rules that, when queried, would generate a list of possible answers, perhaps posing further questions to prune the tree of possible resolutions. So there you have it, syllogistic reasoning of a sort. The most thrilling application of these systems was the Deep Blue chess computer that in 1997 defeated reigning world champion Garry Kasparov by winning 2 out of 6 games and playing to a draw in the other 3. So there's Deep Blue over on the right. Of course, the big black box is what houses the computer, which was essentially estimating the chance of winning by choosing various chess positions. And it could play thousands or even tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of moves ahead to try to find out what would happen if it made a certain decision, and then it would make its decision. I remember all these late 90s things because that was when I was in high school. So that makes it the most thrilling time of my life. With time, however, the symbolic AI paradigm came up against certain limits. Far from extending toward a generalized capacity to deal with all knowledge, expert systems could break down in situations of great subtlety, where the interactions of tens of thousands of rules yielded unexpected and incorrect behaviors. Early researchers successfully implemented Aristotle's theory of syllogistic reasoning and action, but purely symbolic methods could not very well represent knowledge that was less precisely defined, such as, for instance, one's sense of propriety in a social situation, or one's path through a forest or a crowd, rather than through a hospital. And I include this little robot penguin here. That's the one that I and my colleagues built in our summer after our sophomore year of college. And I majored in engineering. We went to the American Association of Artificial Intelligence Conference in Florida that year. And every year, the AAAI had this challenge competition where if you could have a robot, the goal for winning the competition was a robot that would attend the conference, go to the registration desk, register for a talk, deliver its talk, answer questions, and then mingle during the social hour afterwards. But now with ChatGPT, most of that can be done really easily. But back then, it was an incredibly hard problem because we were working within essentially the symbolic AI paradigm. Anything the robot did had to be able to be represented to the robot and explicitly coded for. And you'd be amazed at how hard it is to get this thing to move through a crowd when it's looking for people. But we didn't look for people, we looked for legs. And in the end, it was the kind of halfway to the challenge was to be able to serve hors d'oeuvres during the reception at the end. So that's what this thing is doing. It was a penguin because it was a butler and it was wearing a tuxedo. It's a little joke. It was named Alfred after Batman's butler. And I supplied the British accent for it. I won't attempt it here because we have actual British people in the room. And we won. It was fantastic. But we won through a series of essentially tricks. We looked for legs. We would interact with the robot, would interact with people, and it couldn't understand anything. It couldn't really, speech to text capabilities were pretty primitive then. So if it asked someone their name and they gave the name, the robot would ignore the name and just assign them a name. But then to recognize a person, it couldn't recognize faces. Because back then with symbolic AI, you're like calculating the distance between the eyes and the ratio of the height of the eyes and the length of the nose and stuff. But then as soon as someone turns their face, unless you have some way of, you know, like reorienting the face in the computer, which there were ways, but it was very hard to do this stuff because you had to map everything explicitly and label it. And there were no like deep neural network ways of doing that. So it would assign you a new name, and then it was able to recognize you again, but what it was really recognizing was the color patterns on neckties. So if you were a woman, and you weren't, or if you were a man not wearing a tie, you were fresh out of luck. Like, hopefully you were wearing a very, you know, pattern-filled blouse, and then there would be a chance of you being recognized. Otherwise, it would act like it would, but luckily, you know, whatever mechanisms of, you know, structural sexism or stuff, we're moving in our favor because most of the judges were men wearing ties. And so we were able to win. It was fantastic. But you can see how, in a certain sense, it doesn't really feel like that robot is a Swiss Army knife of useful tools arranged in a sequence to accomplish a particular task. But that's not the same thing as what we do when we socialize in a crowd. And so it felt like it was an extraordinary difficult achievement of engineering, but no one would ever say that was socialization. All right. So, most tellingly, purely symbolic techniques were insufficient for fielding embodied agents in the real world. Robots, humans move easily from sensation to conceptual thought, and thence to action. And this wider field of intelligent behavior has been the subject of deep reflection from antiquity to the present day. Thus, Aristotle writes not only of syllogisms, which is most of what we were using in our robot, but also of the equally fundamental activity of abstraction. In abstraction, something apprehended through the senses, a round, taut-skinned, tart-tasting, misshapen sphere, comes to be understood consciously as an instance of a more general category, an apple. That is, from sensation, one comes to understand some thing. But symbolic methods were clumsy and brittle when it came to distinguishing and identifying objects captured on camera or interpreting human speech recorded through a microphone, tasks that were once expected to be easy in comparison to supposedly higher level activities such as playing chess. So initially in the 50s at the Dartmouth conference on AI, they thought that, you know, text to speech or even translation between languages would be quickly accomplished, but the pinnacle of human intellection, chess, would be the forever out of reach. But it turns out that playing chess is easier with symbolic methods than it is to distinguish between an apple and a nectarine. Because it turns out that our visual world is actually a lot richer than the world of a chessboard. These problems, along with immense advances in computing power, have brought recent prominence to so-called non-symbolic or statistical AI, often implemented by artificial neural networks. An artificial neural network is a computer program that mathematically simulates an interconnected set of simplified brain neurons. So as an AI technique, neural networks begin less from a notion of what human thought is than from an analogy with its biological aspects. That is, the goal of such networks is not human-like reasoning so much as it is neuron-like data processing. A neural network receives a pattern of information as numerical values at its input nodes, and here's the neural network, you know. To represent a picture to a computer, you just have a very long list of numbers that range between 0 and 255 for the brightness of that pixel. And so you feed the numbers in, and then the pattern of information is recombined, added together, and new sums are formed. And when the sum of incoming connections exceeds a particular threshold, then the next neuron fires, similar to the way that brain neurons work, and if you have enough layers of these things, you can put something in on one end and something else comes out. But then the network has to be tuned. And when I was little, I liked to play on the piano. My dad is a pianist, and I took piano lessons too. But you know, at age 3, I wasn't taking piano lessons yet, but I was doing a lot of banging on the piano. And I discovered that if I held down the sustaining pedal, which raises all the dampers so that the strings don't stop sounding, I could make rather thunderous sound. And I would I would go into my dad's closet and take a sport coat, which would reach down to my ankles. And then I would sit at the piano and pound on it with the sustaining pedal held down and pretend that I was a concert pianist. And I discovered that if I held down the sustaining pedal and I shouted into the piano or sang into the piano, I would receive back a kind of echo of my voice. And what was really interesting about it was that it sounded just like me, but it didn't have any shape to the sound. There were no syllables. Because as I later learned in engineering, what was happening was that the piano was accomplishing a frequency decomposition of my voice. Each string is tuned to a different frequency. Our voices, even when we sing, are sounding several frequencies at once, just like light. White light is made out of many frequencies of color. And the piano echo, it gives back, it's attuned to the frequencies of your voice. That's why it sounds like you, even though it's not echoing back the particular words you're stating. And this is something like the tuning of a neural network. You put one thing in on one end, something else comes out the other end. But if you know what you want to get, you can start adjusting the interconnection. And the algorithm for doing this is called backpropagation, which was developed in the 80s, but computers were so slow they couldn't really use it for anything useful. So it wasn't until the early 2000s that these large neural networks became capable of accomplishing amazing things. But like the piano strings, the interconnections of the neural network are being slowly attuned to deep patterns in the incoming data. Patterns that we can sense, like we can recognize faces. We can sense the patterns there, but we have no idea how to express them explicitly. This is why symbolic methods for facial recognition were so brittle. You know, ratio of the eyes and the nose and things like that, because all those things change, and yet we can recognize faces. And we can recognize faces because, you know, somewhere under there, the various levels of cognition and all that, you know, the sensory element and then the cogitative power and then the intellect, we're accomplishing this. This is why, you know, it's a stereotype of Caucasians in the United States that, you know, all white people think that all black people look the same. But the reason for that, the reason why people have such a difficulty in recognizing people from a different ethnic group until they have more experience with them, is because the color of the skin dominates one's awareness. One isn't attuned to the subtleties in that data set. I had a lot of friends from Africa in my engineering program. The former British Empire was well represented at my college. And so most of my friends in engineering were from Hong Kong and India and West Africa, which meant I had a wonderful opportunity to develop my West African accent. My friends from Nigeria and Ghana worked for you. I'll have you critique it later on. What I couldn't do was I could never master the Chinese tones. And the Chinese students would tease me. They would give me things to say like that sounded to me like ma, 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 ma. But it really, like, it's a way of saying something like, I love my mother, but if you say it wrong, it comes out as my grandmother's a cow or something like that. And they would just, you know, they dissolve into laughter. It's great jokes where you can play on Americans. But all of this has to do with this attunement to the deep dynamics of the incoming sensory data. And so a neural network is able to do this handily. And so problems that were impossible for symbolic methods are solved rather handily with a neural network, including facial recognition and playing chess. So the AlphaZero program developed, is it Google that developed the AlphaGo? Someone did anyway, but okay, DeepMind, yeah, did the AlphaGo. Yeah, so the AlphaZero algorithm can be trained to play chess. It can be trained to play StarCraft, which is another computer game from the 90s, for those of you who remember. Yes. It can do lots of things because of this attunement. It's something like what Aristotle is talking about with the development of a second nature. What is second nature in the mind? Here, I decided to go off script here, but whatever. Second nature is an attunement to something through habit. An attunement to a certain pattern of action or response to the goods outside of us. An attunement to faces. So this can be at the sensory level, at the level of desire, at the level of intellect. Aristotle's concept of second nature, Thomas's concept of habitus, which in Latin means clothing, like you're clothing the mind with a certain way of interacting with the world, a certain habit like the Dominicans have, and what we call habit, a kind of acculturation to a certain way of being in the world at its most basic. This is what neural networks are somewhat able to simulate. They develop even what you might call a kind of point of view, although of course without any conscious experience. But crucially, with this style of artificial intelligence, I say down here that framing remains the key. The network can only be trained to do what we ourselves have already named. It's not simply being put out into the world and learning to navigate the world. It's learning a mapping between input and a desired output, which means that if the experimenters or if the designers of the AI system themselves are unaware of some distinction between things, if they don't notice the distinction, it won't necessarily show up in the final system. And this is what we call AI bias, which I'll be talking about on the final day of this, when the system looks like it's doing one thing, but it's actually doing something else, and the problem is only revealed when it begins giving you instructions or making action selections that actually don't meet the goal. So the AI can only carry out the goals that we give it, but sometimes it's uncertain as to which goals we're actually giving it. We're not always giving it the goals we think we are based on the way we label the incoming data and the desired output. The task of ChatGPT and other chatbots, having been trained upon billions of texts, more or less the entirety of the internet, along with the dialogue and commentary tracks of numerous movies, the task is simply to predict the next word. This is how the conversational abilities of so-called large language models are developed. They're just tasked with predicting the next word. That's not the same thing as thinking. But the outgoing behavior from the large language models looks like thinking, because when we say the sort of thing that comes next, usually we're also thinking about it. That's how humans express their interior lives. That's, in fact, how humans actually somewhat regulate their interior lives as well. By hearing what you yourself are saying, you keep yourself on track and kind of probe the landscape of thought. But what ChatGPT and other deep neural networks that have conversational abilities are doing is not probing a landscape of thought or intellectual understanding. What they're doing is probing the landscape of the kind of things that human beings have written on the internet. It's a very different sort of thing, with predictably different results. So if you've ever heard of the original version of ChatGPT, had to be trained not to say certain things. And there it was tech workers in Nigeria who had to spend, who were paid very little, to spend hours interacting with the network and attempting to elicit from it the worst things that someone could ever say, so that those responses could be suppressed, so that the tuning could be adjusted, like a piano tuner listening to the notes and adjusting the tuning of the piano in order to suppress those responses. The Nigerian tech workers, actually, a lot of them quit because it was so upsetting to interact with the statistical landscape of the most vile things that have been said on the internet. So there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood. The sausage is made in a kind of gross way with these things. So, even so, despite their conversational abilities and despite their abilities of recognition and decision making, etc., the functional competence of the neural network is not an unfolding of personal intelligence as traditionally defined. And so I come to the second question. What are these systems? We can ask, what are persons? Large language models and other sociable AIs and decision-making systems are not persons because by their very nature, that is, not by underdevelopment or disability, but by definition, these systems have no subjectivity. They have no conscious experience, and they have no intellectual perspective of the world or of themselves. And without being the sort of thing that ordinarily possesses subjectivity, one is not a person, as I shall explain in a moment. To say that an AI is not conscious is much more than to say that it lacks an immaterial soul. We don't have to believe that gorillas have immaterial souls to affirm that they have a conscious experience of some sort. Not only do they act in ways similar to ours, but they do so by means of a brain, a nervous system, and an embodied existence that, although less complex than ours, is nonetheless of a similar ilk. And here the question was earlier asked about animals and qualia, that there's a qualitative dimension to the functioning of an animal's mind, loosely stated. And the question was asked, well, if there's something immaterial there, does that mean there's an additional spiritual aspect to the animal? And we could say yes in a certain way, but we could also say in another way, what is revealed by our assumption, at least, that animals have an experience, and I'm quite comfortable assuming that they do have an experience, is that the things that we can physically measure, chemistry, atoms, electrons, all that, when configured according to a certain form, do things that can't be measured. So there's something really spooky about that goes on in chemistry that we wouldn't predict by chemistry, which shows that our chemistry is actually an inadequate account even of the potencies of the material world. Artificial neural networks, however, are simulations of physical biological entities. There is no physical network, only a computer program of distilled into ones and zeros that represents equations characterizing the network's behavior. One could run an artificial neural network with a pencil and a notebook. In fact, I did in a class, if only with agonizing slowness. But even simulating an entire brain, or ChatGPT, at present an impossibility, these calculations would not be conscious any more than a student's physics homework has gravity or a flight simulator flies. Some might ask, however, why subjectivity matters. Wouldn't it be more broad-minded to expand our categories of thought, intelligence, and personhood beyond a narrow focus on our own experience? To reply, I will consider the word person, which originally designated the mask worn by an actor on stage. From mask, persona in Latin, came to refer also to the role of a character in a play. And later the word was applied more broadly to one's social identity, the status and activities determined by one's role in Roman society. The meaning of persona was thus external and functional, referring chiefly to what was expected of someone or the role they played in action. And you can see this in if you've ever read the account of the martyrdom of Perpetua and Felicity, running through that account of early Christian martyrdom, they were executed in the year 207, or was it 307? 207, thank you. March 7th, 207. There's a 3, March, yeah. Okay, so they were executed there, and there's a strange moment where Perpetua's father says to her, he's essentially saying, if you are willing to die for Jesus, you must not love me, or you must believe that I don't love you. And it's a kind of odd thing. Like, why should he expect that her particular allegiances to God have anything to do with her allegiance to him? But part of it is because of the culture of the persona in Roman society. She exists at all, first of all, because her father decided not to discard her when she was born. And so in Roman society, your selfhood, the fact that you are a someone, flows from your fulfillment of a persona. First, your role as a child of the paterfamilias. The paterfamilias, by accepting you, and you by exercising piety toward your family, loyalty and good accomplishment of your duty, you sustain your very selfhood. But what Perpetua is saying, and she says, I sought to reassure my father by telling him, it will all happen in the prisoner's dock as God wills, for you may be sure that we are all in his power and are not left alone. We are not left to ourselves. Which to our ears sounds hardly like a reassurance, where she's saying, it's out of our hands, Dad. Like, I'm either going to die or live. God's going to determine it. But actually, the reassurance there is she's reassuring her father that the foundation of her someonehood never flowed from him in the first place. It never even ultimately flowed from Roman society. It came from God, her creator. And so too is the same, for it is true of him as well. And that's reassuring, because for her to step outside of the lines of duty in Roman society is not for her to abandon him, but actually is her pursuit of the deeper foundation of her own personhood in God, a pursuit that he himself could undertake as well. So none of them are abandoned. All of them are in God's hands, because Rome was never the metaphysical foundation of their very selves in the first place. Rome was the modality, the exercise of their personhood. It wasn't the thing that gave them personhood at all. So Christianity radically reinterprets the person, and it begins with a question not about humans, but about divinity. Christians worshipped Jesus of Nazareth as God, not as a God, but the God, the only one. Even so, in their sacred texts, this Jesus speaks to his Father, who is also called God, and he sends a Holy Spirit from the Father. And when the Christians were required to explain themselves, they rather confusingly stated that they believed these three to be one. In the early 3rd century, Tertullian of Carthage called the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit personae, whence Christian theology speaks of the three distinct persons of the one single God. This divine threeness was a problem, for like their Jewish forebears, the early Christians were resolute monotheists. What then are these three personae? They could not be masks. Tertullian rejects any notion that the one God merely play-acted three historical roles or functions. Thus, Tertullian actually rejects my first attempt at Trinitarian theology when I was sitting in Mass one day. I didn't go to a very theologically deep church, parish, when I was little. I went to one with fun music. And I remember when Jesus was praying, and they were reading from the Gospel of John, and Jesus was praying, you know, to his Father. And I remember thinking, like, if Jesus is God, I guess he just was talking to himself then so that people could learn how to pray. And then I felt very satisfied when Jesus said, Father, you already know, but I'm praying aloud so that they may be instructed. And I was like, okay, great. But essentially, I was adopting the account of God that Tertullian is rejecting, that God wears three different masks at various times for our instruction, but really there's just one kind of dude behind all the masks. So Tertullian rejects Jordan Wales' 10-year-old theology. God's historical acts are self-revelatory expressions of his transcendent inner life. Therefore, the appearances of three distinct personae in time are taken to declare some eternal distinction in that inner life. But what is this distinction? If the persons were just separate, then there would be not one God, but three. Scripture offers a clue. Jesus is called the Father's only begotten Son. Now, the Roman gods had done a fair bit of begetting in their day, and it happened largely in the way that it does among us mortals. But the God of Israel is not Jupiter, bodily and time-bound. This, therefore, could be no ordinary begetting. If we remove from the concept of begetting everything that is corporeal or temporal, what are we left with? A timeless handing over of the single divine life from Father to Son. A begetting without bodies is a beginning, but a begetting without bodies and time is a timeless handing over of life from one to the other. This is why the life of the Trinity is called the life of the Father and Son is called the eternal begetting of the Son. In the words of philosopher Robert Spemann, early Christianity came to understand God's very being as existing by the persons transmitting the divine being from one to another in a definite order, having their reality in self-giving and self-receiving. This handing over is what makes the Father to be the Father. It's what makes the Son to be the Son. And without it, they would not exist at all. This is the unique constitution of the divine persons. Like poles of a magnetic field, they exist by their mutual relations. And if one person were taken away, all would cease to be. This is what it means to call God the Trinity. This, we could say, is what it means for God to be love. That the unending, all-at-once life of the one God simply is these relations of self-gift and reception. This account of God reshaped how the word person was applied to human beings. The divine persons exist by relations, and so relationality became essential to a notion of creaturely personhood. The form of divine relationality is that of giving the totality of one's being to another. And so the natural creaturely person came to be seen not as a social role, but as a concrete individual who exercises his or her personhood in mutual relations of self-gift that are self-expressive and other-receiving. By refusing relationships of self-gift, creaturely persons would not cease to exist, but they would live as less than the persons they are. And this, in turn, is why Christian accounts of sexuality differ so much from Roman accounts. In Roman accounts, sexuality was reproduction with a, you know, added bit of enjoyment in it. But Christianity tends to understand sexuality in terms of self-gift. The divine begetting reshapes the way the not only the biological, but also the emotional aspects of sexuality are interpreted within Christianity, thus giving a richer, and I think psychologically speaking, far truer account of what is going on between people in that relationship. So for early Christian thinkers, how one goes about relational self-gift was understood in light of Christianity's other belief, the incarnation. Early Christians were especially struck by Jesus' voluntary sharing in our sufferings, especially on the cross. In this human compassion, they saw a disclosure of his divine life. And so the 6th century Pope Gregory the Great describes compassion as joining in the suffering of one's neighbor, which he understands as taking into oneself the mind of the neighbor, the animus of the neighbor, is taken in through compassion. Not just a kind of uninterpreted emotional experience, but a stance, a point of view on the world, an experience, a sense of who one is in relation to others. You are taking in the mind of the other person. This is what Christ did for us on the cross. And so Gregory writes that as the Son was our co-knower, our conscius on the cross, so the Father is the Son's co-knower within the life of the Trinity. We imitate the lives of the divine persons in their single mind when, by voluntary empathic self-gift, we take in the mind of the other and so imitate the self-gift by which the persons of God exist. From the exteriority of mask, we have come to the person deeply interior while simultaneously relationally oriented to the other. The person as relationally empathic aligns also with the Christian tradition's view of intelligence. Yes, excellent. In Latin, intelligentsia, or understanding. This is the third claim I shall make. The intelligence of AI, externally measured goal achievement, is different from human intelligence, which is traditionally much deeper. Intelligentsia, from intelligere, to understand, is a personal grasp, an intuitive apprehension by the relational person of something as the thing that it is. It is an aspect of our nature as rational. As the 5th century Christian philosopher Boethius affirmed, The person is an individual substance of a rational nature. Now, for various reasons since the late 20th century, Boethius's definition of the person as rational has been criticized as excessively narrow. But this is in part because our notions of individual, as Father James pointed out, and our notions of rational have become too narrow, focused on propositional reasoning or on accomplishing goals in the material world. In particular, if you're a fan of Star Trek, as I was back in the 90s, the greatest era of American history, you will remember the character of Mr. Spock, who lives a life of pure reason by suppressing all of his emotions. And so there's a sense of the narrowing of reason to, like symbolic AI, propositional calculation. Christianity's traditional usage, however, is more expansive. In Boethius, as generally in early and medieval Christianity, the rational nature orients the human being toward understanding, intelligentsia, intelligence. This understanding is not first a mastery of calculation, but an interiorly experienced cognitive grasp, a hold on some reality beyond oneself as being the thing that it is. This sort of intelligence is an experiential engagement with reality. To understand is to have a point of view on some facet of reality, a view that is sharpened by, but that is not identifiable with, either a course of logical argument or a policy of action. There's something that underlies the logical argument and endows it with meaning. And I have a beautiful passage from Joseph Pieper that I'm not going to read. You can ask me to read it in the question session because I'm sensitive to the progress of time. We can't escape temporality or corporeality in the begetting of knowledge in this classroom. Every act of understanding involves an act of will. And here I'm going to look not to Thomas, but to Augustine. I am assured by Father Anselm that at some deep level, Thomas and Augustine are reconcilable. But I happen to be a stronger student of Augustine than of Thomas. So for Augustine, every act of understanding involves an act of will. Our understandings of natural things, of written text, conventional signs, and of the things that we make all follow the same fundamental sequence. We apprehend something through the senses and come to some initial knowledge of it. Then we judge that thing as good. And to judge something as good for Augustine is to judge it as real. When we're laying hold of the good of something, we're laying hold of what is real in it. And we make this judgment of its goodness in light of some standard, ideally the goodness of God himself, rather than simply what makes me comfortable or gets me more money or prestige or something. And then having judged the goodness of something in light of some standard, we cling to that goodness with our love. And in doing so, we conceive a mental word, the verbum mentis, a conceptual understanding. This mental word is not a spoken word or a thought word. It is not a propositional definition, but it is the mind's particular embrace of some facet of reality, an embrace, however, that is shaped by the knower's own assessment of the thing's goodness. And this assessment is not something that we sort of think our way through. We can think to get to it, but this assessment is far deeper. It is intuitive. It is, you could say, in a certain sense, instinctual. And this is why it is so important for the Christian life, according to Augustine, to shape one's desires in accord with what is actually good. And when one desires something, to ask oneself what one really desires. So looking back to, you know, common challenges for young people in college age or young adults, right? They might think they're desiring sex. And Augustine would say, well, what are you desiring more deeply? What is the good that you are seeking? The deeper good that they're seeking might be a sense of interpersonal communion or even deep validation in themselves, which can be encountered, which can be actually laid hold of in deeper and more enduring ways than through a promiscuous series of one-night stands, etc. So the knowledge and understanding of something comes about not only through us sensing some good there, but judging what in it is the good to which we are attracted, and thus begetting the mental word. This verbum, this mental word, is truer as it approaches an embrace of the thing as it truly is. its ratio, its intrinsic coherence. Therefore, for a correct intelligentsia, one's own desire and love must conform to reality rather than plucking out from reality only whatever seems congenial to my interests in the moment. Even our understandings of dinosaurs and no parking signs are not neutral for Augustine, because these acts of understanding, issue from judgments of meaning that we make from within the general frame of what is valued in ourselves and by our society. Every act of understanding entails a moral judgment, and our habitual moral judgments form our habit of seeing the world. This is why our loves, for Augustine, will lead us rightly when they are directed most deeply to the goodness of God. A particular person may lack these capacities of empathy and intelligence by deficit and yet still remain a person. But a being that can engage neither in compassion nor in adopting a point of view and sensing some good is not a personal being. So to see AIs as persons, we would have to redefine personhood apart from interiority and compassion, because AIs lack subjectivity. To exclude AIs from the category of person, then, is a statement not about biology, but about subjectivity and self-gift. And to call AIs persons would not expand our categories. It would just reduce person to mask, to mere exteriority. But the apparently personal AI is a mask of sorts. By the role it plays, whether it's the little robot from 1999 or whether it's ChatGPT, its imitation of human behavior is a mask or an echo, not a reproduction, but a reflection, a diluted image of our own personhood. It is artificial in the original sense of the word, an artifact, a work of skill that we have brought forth by gazing into a computational pool of Narcissus. And I put the image there from that's Dante's Paradiso, where Dante and, is that Dante and Bernard, are gazing together on the mystery of the Trinity, not just the mystery of the Trinity, they're gazing upon the life of God with the angels and saints ranged around the life of God. And Dante says, I saw ingathered there and bound as if in a single volume what is through the universe as scattered pages. And so Dante finds in God the unity of all knowledge, in that self-gift of the begetting of the Son by the Father. So here you have this intellect and will, this knowledge and love united in one in the life of God. And so the consummation of intelligentsia, the consummation of our individual acts of understanding, is for Augustine, for Thomas, for us to gather up our knowledge of the world through a love oriented toward God, so that these little finite goods that we know through our finite loves are reconciled in their original source, which is the interpersonal life of the triune God. Fourth, what do we lose if we identify our personhood and our intelligence with the behavior of AI? Indeed, many do not wish to deny personhood to the compelling AI conversationalist or the effective AI agent. And so they redefine personhood again in terms of the behavior that we interpret as appropriate to a person. And intelligence becomes competence in goal-directed behavior. However, if we treat goal-directed behavior not as a goal for the computer program, but as a definition of intelligence, then our account of intelligence edges toward what is called behaviorism. That is, we define intelligence, we define relationships, we define personhood without reference to any inner life, but only as a tendency to exhibit certain observable actions under certain conditions. Indeed, Arthur C. Clarke once invoked Turing's test of sociable behavior to make those who oppose the claim that computers think mere splitters of non-existent hairs. Arthur C. Clarke wrote, essentially, if you can't tell the difference, what meaningful difference is there? This redefinition of intelligence has long been a basic assumption of contemporary work in AI and robotics. When AI pioneer John McCarthy proposed the seminal 1956 Dartmouth Conference on AI, he defined the artificial intelligence problem as that of making a machine behave in ways that would be called intelligent if a human were so behaving. It's a question of behavior. Computer scientists Stuart Russell and Peter Norvig defined the rational agent as one that acts so as to achieve the best outcome, or where there is uncertainty, the best expected outcome. Applied to robots, rational agency does not refer to how some behavior comes about, but just to the success of that behavior as interpreted by humans. And since that success must be measurable, that behavior must be oriented toward materially measurable goals in the finite material world. So intelligence becomes a matter not of personal engagement with reality, but just of functional competence, that is, efficacy in accomplishing measurable goals. All right, I'm going to skip a bit. Does this really matter? What happens when we make this reduction? Well, if we allow the sociable behavior of AIs to count as personal behavior, then we all become masks. And friendship, romance, the love of a parent for a child become a matter of behaviorally mediated optimization of goals. We lose herein what makes behavior most personal. What we speak of when we talk about very personal conversations, or a personable demeanor, or matters that are strictly personal between persons. These are all things in which the intimacy of the heart, the interiority of the psychological experience, and the effort to cast oneself into another's mind are at stake. But a behavioral definition of personhood, a behavioral definition of relationships, loses this interior dimension that intuitively, I would argue, we most prize. A similar loss occurs also when we reduce intelligence to goal accomplishment. Let us return to our friend Yuval Harari and his claim that intelligence is the ability to solve problems, and that these problems are simply those that arise in a world that is itself a great machine to be mastered. Despite Harari's confidence, Western culture seems not entirely comfortable with embracing this narrow and lifeless vision of intelligence built upon a narrow and lifeless vision of a mechanical world. Indeed, popular culture is saturated by stories that warn against one possible outcome of an exclusively problem-solving intelligence, the evil genius, always covetously trying to take over the world. Genius itself does not seem to be the problem. Psychologically oriented takes on this trope, from the devil in Milton's Paradise Lost to Gru in the children's movie series Despicable Me, suggest that great intelligence seeks diabolical domination only as a distorted bid for recognition by a creator or parent whose full love one thought oneself to be denied. And there was a recent book published about highly successful families in which not just one child in the family, but all the children are incredibly accomplished. And the sociologist who wrote this book pointed out that it is the case in these highly successful families that on the negative side, in general, the parents do not praise the children. Nothing's ever quite good enough. And so the child is anxiously always striving for the thing that will be good enough until they take over the world. But the other thing on the positive side in the highly successful families, the siblings tend to cheer one another on. And so that's why all of them all of them attempt in finite and temporal means to achieve the infinite, since nothing was ever good enough for their parents collectively. However, our theological investigation of intelligentsia suggests an additional explanation for the haunting of the Western imagination by these and other figures, such as Dr. Faustus, Dr. Frankenstein, Tolkien's Sauron, Rogue One's director Krennic, and of course the malevolent Skynet AI from The Terminator. Great intelligence seeks comprehensive engagement. And when intelligence as a problem-solving ability is applied to simply the finite and material world as the total horizon of problem solving,
the comprehensive actualization of that intelligence must entail the manipulative mastery of all things. For the Western imagination, when one is alienated from God, or when God has never existed, comprehension easily entails domination. Answering both origin stories for the evil genius, the Christian concept of the person as empathically relational and of intelligence as a participation in the world and God honors particular things while directing one's apprehension of finite goods back to the inexhaustible good, God himself. Contrarily, an intelligence that can only solve problems in a world forever decaying and renewing itself must ultimately turn, as Harari indeed argues, and as the transhumanists argue, to overcoming transience itself, overcoming the passing away of finite things, which actually in Tolkien's Silmarillion is the problem of the elves. The elves remain in Middle-earth. They don't go to the Isle of the Angels when they're called because they can't bear to allow finite things to pass away. However, an intelligence that is constrained by the material world, the effort to escape all loss must lead to a competition to dominate scarce resources. We can only simulate infinity by gobbling up all that is finite. Christian intelligence, on the other hand, needn't end in competition because it overcomes transience both by ingenious solutions to material need and by the higher goal of union with God. So Dante's vision. And participation in his imperishable and self-giving beauty. This full contemplative intelligent comprehension is simultaneously a loving possessing of all things and a state of being possessed or embraced by one who is love, the rational, relationally consummated. This spiritual intelligentsia can explain both the exhilaration of the inventor and the silence of the Carthusian monk, and incipiently combining these two, the young child's hours-long fascination with a bug's transit across a limpid puddle after a rainstorm. This is an intelligent befitting of persons and of their source in the life of the self-giving God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.